Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Karan Bajaj, and he is the author of The Yoga of Max's Discontent. And Karan, I would love to talk. I want to mention something. In this book, it's a novel, The Yoga of Max's Discontent, but some of it is kind of autobiographical from your own experience. And there's something that I wanted to read because I think it's a really, you capture something here. And this is a scene where Max, who is your main character in the book, he's traveling with two men on motorcycles in this remote part of northern India. And so he's traveling with Omkara and Shiva. And Omkara says, "All over the world, people are striving for progress. Only in India can you live naked in the mountains like a caveman and have idiots ask for your blessings." And Shiva replies and responds to that, and he says, "They aren't cavemen. They've just realized sooner than all the rest of us that man's soul cries for the infinite in a finite world. That is why nothing ever satisfies us." Now, I really felt in this passage, it really captures something about humankind's source of longing, that we have this, if we uncover and unpack all of our habits and our train of thought and all that comes to clutter our lives, if we uncover all of that, we come to this deep longing that is present. I'd love for you to say something about your experience of that.
Oh, yeah, thank you. And this particular passage is very, actually, thank you for picking this up because it's very interesting for me personally also because it captures even the battle in India almost because there is this external directed wanting very materialistic India and, you know, is becoming even more materialistic now. And then there is always the kind of the underlying spiritual tradition in the country. And I was trying to capture both because I think what happens in novels is that novels that are set in India romanticize it too much when they're written from a Western perspective and never capture that materialism that is also very inherent in the country. So that's it's interesting that you read the passage. But to answer your question, though, yeah, I like this analogy in the Yoga Sutras very much, in which it says that man's journey is like the flight of an eagle, in which the first part of the journey is to spread your wings high as you can take them and grow and fly, which means it's all about that longing is expressed through experiences in the world and flight and growth. And then it comes a time when the eagle has to bring its wings down and complete its journey, if you will. Like, you know, it has to move away from external flight to going within. And that's the second part of the journey where you have pushed the limit of experiences in the world and gotten everything that you can out of that. And then you have to go back to the source and find your completeness there. So in a sense, I think that's a very good analogy of man's journey, that like both are important experience and then contemplation and connecting to the energy within and like, you know, like completing the journey, if you will. Yeah.
And in doing this, we often have to then incorporate this as we go along too. I mean, it's not just okay that we get all these experiences and then sometime later on we start to integrate them. But it's both and, isn't it?
Yes, it is indeed. And the only thing is that your purpose of that journey would be a little like, for example, if meditation is your way of forming that connection, it's almost like meditation in the beginning phases is just to give you the stability to make your life in the world more productive. And then it kind of morphs into a very serious practice, which is really meant to connect you very completely within. And like, so you almost have to go from that meditator who uses meditation to be successful in the world to somebody who's almost like a cave dweller, whether physically or not, who's relinquishing all sense of self, ego, expression in the world to go within.
So many of us, when we're doing our meditation practice, is to be less stressful, let's say. There's some goal, so to speak. And you're saying that there comes a time as we continue this practice that all of that will dissolve?
Yeah, I think the fundamental disconnect is that in the West, meditation has become
A commodity,
a practice to almost further your sense of self. Like, so the whole movement of you'll become even more productive so that you can do even more work, and you'll become calmer and less stressed so that you'll be even more efficient and effective. While the point in the East is essentially is that meditation is a way of completely extinguishing your sense of self and becoming one with the infinite. So it's almost like there's a pretty big, like I would say, fundamental disconnect that you're not furthering your sense of self and in like true meditation in the East, you are like diminishing or completely kind of eliminating your sense of self, if you will.
So going back to your own journey on yoga, what is the attraction for you in the practice of yoga? Why did this attract you?
Very good question. I think part of it is a little bit, honestly, maybe it sounds so like hokey, but like, I think past lives and stuff, really, I've had a very strong pull right from quite early. I've been very interested in the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishad. So I would read a lot of like Eastern text. But I think all of those questions were very intellectual for me for a long period of time. And I would read all these texts very intellectually. My mom had a very dramatic decline from cancer at age 54, 55, when she was pretty young. I was 26, 27. And I was very close with her during that time. I took like time off from work and was with her in her last phases. And I think seeing the human body decline in a very kind of rough, dramatic kind of way, I think that put my questions on the meaning of suffering. Why does it happen? It became very urgent for me to answer that. So I think then the practice shifted from a very intellectual, theoretical kind of practice to being a way for me to truly reach a satisfying conclusion to why all this happens. Like, how do you explain karma? And is this the law of cause and effect? And can I truly, like, what does it mean? So I wanted to go from, so in Buddhism, they say there are three stages of learning. Sharana, Manana, Nididhyana, which means the first stage of learning is you read, and like, you know, external sources. The second stage of learning is that you reflect on what you're reading. And then your third and final stage of learning is that you experience what you are learning. And that's when the learning becomes true. So I think I was for like many, many years, I was at the bottommost stage of learning. And I think my mom's kind of decline led me to reflect. And then it led me to truly experience things, teachings, and reach to some kind of a conclusion which would satisfy me about why life exists when it seems all seems so purposeless.
When you do yoga, it's more than just postures. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I follow the old Ashtanga, or the eight limbs of yoga, which is really asana is at the, like, you start with like very good ethical practices, then you go to asana or poses, and then you go to the dharana, dhyana, samadhi, which is the concentration, meditation, and samadhi is obviously enlightenment. I try to follow the eight limbs, if you will, that pyramid of like going from the physical practice being a way to prepare myself mentally towards, the union with the infinite, if you will.
And also having a strong body, like a vehicle to strengthen the body is your vehicle for it. You mentioned briefly about the meaning of life. That is the question. What is the meaning of life? Have you found a truth on which you can stand? Have you found something that is stable, that holds you?
I think these things are a little hard to kind of give a one-line summary about, but I feel much more stable and content than I felt a few years ago. And that's, I would attribute a lot of it to the yoga and meditation practice. But in some ways, I feel the true meaning of life is what the definition of yoga in Sanskrit is chitta vritti nirodha, which means stopping the fluctuations of the thought waves of the mind, which really means that your sense of individual self dissolves completely. So I'm quite like, I'm very like, I think that's my definition of the meaning of life. So in my own small way, what I'm trying to do is to become a conduit for my work, to become just a medium or a channel for my work. So whenever I'm working in my corporate life or I'm writing, I'm trying to kind of dissolve off all sense of doership and just become a way to, I guess, become a vessel to express myself. So in some small way, I'm trying to live a meaning, like a meaningful way, even if I'm in very kind of corporate-ish environments. I'm trying to be very selfless and egoless, but not even trying to be. I'm trying to be I'm trying to get to that point where I just spontaneously become a medium for my work, really.
So what you're talking about in dissolving our small self into this infinite self or energy or whatever we want to call it, it's not about, this is my question. Is it about transcending life? I mean, it's, I guess that's one of my deep questions, that we're born in this particular incarnation, in this material, physical body, in this physical world. And I guess that there would be some, especially, let's say, in India, there are some aesthetics that would just want to transcend the body and just, you know, let go of everything and just become one with the universe beyond the body. But I'm not sure that that's really what you're talking about.
I think it would be my goal as well at the end, but I think I truly, fully, like if you really ask me, I'm completely internalized that sutra's belief that I was talking about, where everybody's at different stages of that eagle's flight, if you will. Some people are still in the growth, evolution, spreading the wings phase, and a small minority of people have fully brought the wings down. So when you talk about the ascetics in India, which I spent a lot of time up within the Himalayas, if you ask them, they have, it's a very conscious pull away from the world, because they viscerally know and believe that in incarnations past and even in the present incarnation, they have experienced everything that the world has to offer. And they are consciously pulling away and going within. And that's their kind of journey, because they, like you know, they would talk about like how they've experienced, like there's nothing in this world of senses that pulls them anymore. Where I am in my journey is that I'm not there. So I think I have some lives to go before I end up being that, being the ascetic who kind of brings his wings down. But I do believe that that is the journey of the, like, I think that's the reason for man to exist, that he reaches a point where he feels that everything in the world has been experienced and now have to go within and complete the journey, like, if you will, and, like, you know, live a life of contemplation and away from the senses,
I'm here with Karan Bajaj, and he is the author of The Yoga of Max's Discontent. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Here with Karan Bajaj, and he is the author of The Yoga of Max's Discontent. Karan, I'd love for you to say, there was another phrase that you use in How to Change Your Life, and you advise us, become a venture capitalist monk. I love that. I love that. So it's not a matter of quitting your day job. Your day job may subsidize that creative act. So what do you mean by becoming a venture capitalist monk?
No, thank you for mentioning that. It's a funny one because there are actually two components to it. One was the venture capitalist idea being that I've seen a lot of people work in their day jobs, sit in expensive restaurants and complain about their day job and like, I'm not getting time. And my idea there was, if that's where you are, that you are stuck in a day job and you don't have like the time to build your art, cut everything out of your life, which is superfluous, eating in restaurants, doing this, doing that, all these kind of busy activities, take all that money and channelize into your art. And save your time and money in superfluous activities. So in that way, you're a monk. You're not doing any superfluous activities. All you exist for is working so that you can make money and art so that you can... But I'm not quite like that. Like, I'm quite happy with my job. But if you're really in an unhappy job and your solution is your art and you can't make money out of it, cut everything out of your life. Become a monk and just work and then come back and do your art. Take all the money from your work and put it into your art. And sooner or later, you'll... start building a following that way, and like slowly you can kind of start transitioning into a full-time artist life.
And then you are really investing in yourself.
Exactly.
And that is another one of yours, to invest in your own growth.
Exactly.
So this is where you're subsidizing that growth.
Yeah.
And if you look at your work, even if it's not the most pleasant work or you're not happy in it, if you take the time for your creative passions, then you're really becoming your own investor.
Exactly, absolutely. And the funny thing I've seen is, and this could be just an individual phenomenon, and that's why I don't want to make it like a rule, and I haven't even made it a rule for myself, is that every time I've invested in my art, it always comes back in droves. So if I think of my second novel, I really did a very, very, very strong marketing plan behind it, invested a ton of money beyond the advance which HarperCollins gave me. I invested much more money beyond that using my day job to fund a very strong marketing plan. And then the movie deal that came back paid all of the effort that I'd put in. And then I think of my sabbaticals again and again. I've seen the same principle that I take a year off, and that year is a year of tremendous growth and transformation in new dimensions. But once I come back, they have a very tremendous effect in my material life, right? So if I, like, after a year of doing yoga and meditation, I came back and I got promoted 2 or 3 times in a row quickly. And I couldn't attribute it to anything apart from, I guess, the stillness and calm which came from those practices helping me better, being better at my job. So every time I've invested, I guess, in that way, because in that year I lost money, if you will, because I wasn't earning, I was living in ashrams and all that stuff. It always comes back after a couple of years because I've transformed, and that transformation shows in every activity.
So, Karan, you're not saying that there's a guarantee here. That's not what you're saying. But you're saying in your experience, because you were, I would describe it as so at one with it, that you're so motivated and invested in it, in a kind of purity, I guess I would call it a purity of action, that it came back to you in very surprising ways. That's the kind of, like, in my introduction, the zigzag of life.
Yes.
It zigged and it zagged, and you couldn't even predict it.
You couldn't predict it. And like, all I know now is that anytime I'm making a choice of growing, transforming, becoming deeper, more three-dimensional, it always has a positive impact on in disconnected or unconnected ways. Because I know, for example, that I would never have gotten to a C-level position. Like, I became a CMO, chief marketing officer of a startup, and then I'm becoming a CEO of a media company now. I would never have gone from, I would say, slightly above middle management to like the C-level so quickly. It's all I completely attributed to yoga, meditation, and writing novels. I just, I like, I, there is no other way to explain it, because I've realized that those activities make me deeper, three-dimensional, more ambiguous, more intuitive, because I'm an engineer. I'm very rational. I can, like, even like you said, like in the blog, I would quote statistics on, like, I can't make a simple point without my statistics, you know? So I'm just like, I'm trained to be very left-brained. And I think all of these activities make me much more, balance me out, make me much more intuitive. And that always has a effect on work and really kind of spirals it up. So that's why I think it always, like, at least, I mean, again, I don't want to make it a rule. I could be just one lucky person, but I always feel that it comes back.
So it's being in flow in some ways, yeah. As Csikszentmihalyi has talked about this in previous books, and he talks about flow and being in flow. Yeah. And it seems to me that that's what you're talking about.
Exactly. I think we came back to the original point in the discussion, which is I think all of these lives are one integrated flow, because if all of this stuff impacts my corporate life, now, for example, when I end up leading this media channel in India, I'm going to get exposure into a whole new world, which I think will in turn influence my art in a much better way than sitting in Brooklyn and writing in a cafe. Like, because I'm going to be in the real world, I'll be working in Mumbai with like movies and entertainment, and I'm going to learn things that I've never learned before. And I might end up writing a crime novel set in Mumbai, Bollywood. Like, I guess I'm saying that's much, like, it feels like that would be more inspirational than now going back to Brooklyn and writing in a cafe the same novel that I've written again in a different form.
You know? Right, and there are many writers who do that. They keep writing the same thing over and over.
Which could be there, yeah, like, I think, like, but I think this, like, if I start thinking of everything as one stream, then I think this could be creative inspiration for the next book, and then the next book would provide more depth for the corporate life. Like, it's all flowing into
one. So again, going back to what you opened with, it's like reimagining our life over and over, recreating our life. It's like we reach some place and then you talk about let that dissolve.
Exactly. Break it down.
Break it down. And or you use the metaphor of the well, you know, so you empty that well and now you've got to fill it up with something brand new.
Exactly. Exactly. And now attachment would be, I've written this novel that is successful. Now let me quickly write a new novel so that I can capitalize on my audience. I don't think the world will reward that kind of attachment. I think the Buddhist approach is that whatever success or failure I've gotten here, let it pass. And now, like, you know, choose growth, depth, becoming three-dimensional, silence, like whatever form you choose. And then if you have to express yourself through writing again, it'll happen. And, you know, and hopefully the audience remains. Or if it doesn't remain, you know, like, just keep going.
Non-attachment. This is very, very, very good. Very good. So, and I think that also you're asking us to be fiercely critical of the choices that we make in how we spend our time, that we need to really look at that and dissect that and say, okay, you know, what is it? When do I feel most alive? And you talk about the creative process is when you feel most alive. And I think most of us can really identify with that when we've done some sort of creation of some sort, and then we feel alive. But that means that we have to make choices in our life about how we spend our time.
Yeah, very much agree. Yeah.
So I want to go out on one. How has your daughter changed your life?
Two daughters now.
Oh, you have two daughters. Yes. Oh,
one is 2 years old and one is 3-4 months old. 4 months old now. Yeah. Like in all the usual, so the surprising thing is actually how it has not changed my life, because the changing your life is very like what you can expect. Like, you know, you feel an explosion of love that you never feel before. All those things have happened. But what I thought, which is very different, was that I was almost in a hurry to do things before my daughters, because I'd like brought into the world, I guess, mythology that the moment your kids are born, your dreams will die and you'll become this steady, like, you know, career guy who's not going to take any risks at all because it's like impacts your daughter's future. But I, that aspect hasn't happened at all. I have actually felt that my risk appetite has grown tremendously after having my daughters because I really have brought into this research, and which I really see in action also, that there's this beautiful research from the Wall Street Journal where the number of books that are in your house is a better predictor of whether your kids will read versus whether you read to them or not. Or sorry, versus whether you tell them to read. Because the number of books in that, you may never read to your kids, but if you are a reader, the kid will pick it up. Versus if you're not a reader and you're trying to read to your kids, they'll never pick it up. So really, you have to lift yourself up as a person. So for me to tell them that you can become the president of the United States while I'm like completely narrow and one-dimensional in my thinking and trying to just basically be as risk-averse as possible will never give them the courage and the liberation to become presidents of the United States. So the whole point is that like I felt that more risk-friendly because I think I have to lift myself up so that they emulate me.
I want to thank you so much, Karin, for being here with us today.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Karin Bajaj, and he is the author of The Yoga of Max's Discontent. And if you want to know more about his work and his blogs, his YouTubes, his videos, you can go to his meditation courses. You can go to KarinBajaj.com, and he spells his name KarinBajaj.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3585.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Carol S. Pearson, author of Persephone Rising, Awakening the Heroine Within. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about transforming our lives through transforming our stories.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.